Nutrition and has been with the Meningitis and Vaccine Preventable Diseases Branch at CDC for 5 years. She is the subject matter expert for meningococcal disease and is a CDC lead of the ACIP Meningococcal Vaccines Working Group. So her talk is called Meningococcal Conjugate Vaccines, Updated Recommendations for Adolescents. Welcome, Amanda.
Thank you. Good morning, and thanks for being here. I'm more vertically challenged than Shannon, so I'll be on my tippy toes. So today I'm going to talk about recent recommendations that were made to optimize the meningococcal adolescent vaccination program. And the goals of the presentation are both for you to understand what those recommendations are, but more importantly, to provide some context and some rationale behind these new recommendations. These recommendations were definitely controversial, and difficult decisions were made at the ACIP. And I think some of the reasons for this was that, you know, this disease is a devastating disease. And as you saw on Tuesday morning session, there are thousands and thousands of cases that are occurring in the meningitis belt in Africa. But in the United States, this really doesn't cause nearly as much disease. The burden is relatively low. But it is a devastating disease, and every case is really very very difficult for families, for communities. And so that sort of makes these recommendations are very charged, and we really want to do the best we can to protect adolescents. Also, we have some assumptions about long-term protection that have been changing over time, and how we understood conjugate vaccines in relation to meningococcal disease 5 years ago have really changed when we made the recommendations compared to now. So meningococcal disease is caused by Neisseria meningitidis. It's a gram-negative bacilli, and serogroups B, C, and Y are the most common in the U.S. And the serogroups we can protect against right now are C and Y, and they're in the quadrivalent vaccines. We still don't have vaccines available for serogroup B. There's three syndromes, meningitis, bacteremia, and pneumonia. And bacteremia, about 10%, 20% of cases are meningococcemia, which is the fulminate disease, which often results in death. There's very high morbidity and mortality of meningococcal disease. In adolescents, 1 in 4 or even up to 1 in 3 cases either dies or has very severe long-term sequelae from disease, such as limb loss, kidney damage. It's very tragic. And most disease occurs in previously healthy persons. And so these are the two outbreaks of the past year. If you're from either Oklahoma or Colorado, you'll remember these well. In Oklahoma, in an elementary school, there were several cases of meningococcal disease in a very short period of time over the span of a couple of days, and there were several deaths. And in Colorado, an outbreak occurred, which began actually in a hockey league and then extended to Fort Collins and Colorado State University, there were also several deaths in that outbreak this past year. Ironically, neither of these outbreaks were in the adolescent age group, which we're trying to protect, which may be related to our vaccination efforts. So this shows you the incidence of meningococcal disease since the 1980s. In 1980, meningococcal polysaccharide vaccines were licensed, but they were really never used in the U.S., and our rates of disease were about 1 per 100,000, but polysaccharide vaccines were focused on people who were at increased risk for disease, persons with complement component deficiencies and asplenia, persons who were traveling to the meningitis belt. So there were no wide-scale, there was no wide-scale use of polysaccharide vaccine. In the year 2000, a lot of work had been done to really recognize that college freshmen living in dorms were at increased risk for meningococcal disease, and they did recommend that polysaccharide vaccine be considered for persons who are going to college. And so those recommendations were made in the year 2000 and were for a very limited group of adolescents, those college freshmen who were going to be living in dorms. And some colleges and universities made those recommendations broader and would recommend all entering college freshmen to be vaccinated prior to entry. However, what you see is after the year 2000, and I don't think this is related to the college recommendations at all, our rates of meningococcal disease really plummeted. And so in the year 2005, typically you're used to seeing drastic declines in disease after a vaccine's introduced. In the case of our meningococcal recommendations, there were drastic reductions in disease in the 10 years prior, in the 5 years prior to vaccine introduction. And so we made these general recommendations for meningococcal conjugate vaccines in the setting of very low disease burden. So why did we recommend these vaccines in the first place? Conjugate vaccines are expected to provide long-term protection, even though we know that circulating antibody can decline. So while polysaccharide vaccines we thought would protect for 3 to 5 years, there's an expectation that conjugate vaccines would protect for at least 10 years. And it's the properties of conjugate vaccines, such as inducing a T-cell response, immunologic memory, and herd immunity, that led us to believe that these vaccines would protect against meningococcal disease. We also had experience of several recent and dramatic conjugate vaccine success stories, the two in the United States being HIV vaccine and pneumococcal vaccine. And we achieved high coverage in young children very quickly with both of those programs and had dramatic declines in disease and prevented thousands of cases a year for both of those, and saw, for HIV vaccine at least, a 99% reduction in disease. We also have the example of MenC conjugate vaccines in the United Kingdom, and they had much higher rates of MenC disease than we currently do in the United States. They vaccinated their entire population, less than 19 years of age, in a large-scale campaign. They achieved high vaccination coverage, I think about 90% in about a year, and they really wiped out serogroup C disease, which was caused by a clonal strain that was circulating in the United Kingdom. And they've seen long-term reductions in disease. So they did this in the year 2000, and they still have very little serogroup C disease. So in 2005, the original recommendations were made for meningococcal conjugate vaccine, but in 2007, they were expanded. And so the recommendations are that 11 and 12-year-olds receive their vaccine at their adolescent vaccination visit that Shannon was just focusing on, and that for 13 and 18-year-olds who hadn't been previously vaccinated, that they should be vaccinated as well. So in general, all 11 to 18-year-olds were recommended for a single dose of meningococcal conjugate vaccine. There are two licensed products for ages 2 to 55 years old. The first is Menactra, and this one's been licensed since 2005, and it protects against serogroups ACWY, and it's conjugated to diphtheria toxoid. The second, Menvio, has been licensed more recently, protects against the same serogroups, but is conjugated CREM-197. So this slide shows you the rates of meningococcal disease by single year of life. And what I want you to look at here, the blue is serogroup C and the yellow is serogroup Y, is really our rates of serogroup C and Y disease in adolescents start to increase at age 16. They don't start to increase in the 11 to 14-year-olds, and we really see the increase from ages 16 to 21 years. But we put the vaccine recommendation at the 11 to 12-year-old visit, both to strengthen the adolescent platform, but also because we had assumptions about the long-term protection of these vaccines, and we assumed that they would protect kids through this period of increased risk through age 21 years. And that's really important to understand in terms of why we had to make changes to this program. And we have seen some success with meningococcal conjugate vaccines. In 2006 and 2007, our rates of C and Y disease were 0.27 per 100,000 in 11 to 19-year-olds. And we've seen 2 years later, our coverage in 2006 and 2007 was fairly low. And we've increased it in 2008 and 2009, and our rates of disease declined. They almost halved to 0.14 per 100,000. And as you can see, for comparison, in the older than 20-year-olds, which are not vaccinated, they did not see similar declines in disease. So I do think that we're seeing some impact from meningococcal conjugate vaccines. This slide, however, showed that there is somewhat of an age variation. And so our coverage for meningococcal conjugate vaccines by age group in the 13 to 17-year-olds is similar, but we're seeing bigger reductions in disease in 11 to 14-year-olds compared to that middle age group, that 15 to 18-year-old age group, which is really where we think the disease risk starts to increase. So in 2005 to 2009, we only saw about 12 average annual cases in 11 to 14-year-olds, but we're still seeing about 77 average annual cases in 15 to 18-year-olds. And so we still have about 141 cases of meningococcal disease that are vaccine-preventable occurring each year in the United States. We've also had multiple reports of meningococcal disease among persons previously vaccinated. And so to date, there have been over 30, I think the count's probably 40 this week. We hear sort of, you know, usually in the winter months we get these reports. But it's really has been highly concerning, and we've been hearing these for several years. The biggest concern is that the case fatality ratio of these cases who are vaccinated is high, so it's 20%, which is similar to people who are unvaccinated. So we're not seeing attenuated disease. We're really seeing fulminant meningococcal disease in persons who are vaccinated. And we've been recognizing that there's been an increasing number of vaccinated cases who were vaccinated several years ago. And so I'm going to present the results. These are preliminary results of a vaccine effectiveness study that was conducted that was begun shortly after conjugate vaccine, Menactra, was licensed. And the reason why we say that this is a vaccine effectiveness study for Menactra is that because Menveo, the second vaccine, was really only licensed a year ago, almost all these cases to this point, actually all of the cases to this point, have received Menactra. And now, as we continue on with this study, we'll start to also look at the effectiveness of Menveo. So to date, there have been 207 eligible cases and 120 enrolled cases, and this shows you just some basic demographics of the cases. We've enrolled 168 controls, so we were trying to match four cases per control, but it's been a very difficult study, and we've managed to enroll one to two controls for most of the cases. This study is the work of 29 state health departments have been working on this study for the last couple of years, and it's been a very long study because of the low burden of disease. And so my thanks goes out to those health departments that have been helping with this. So the results of this study show that among all cases that we've had to this date, vaccine effectiveness for 0 to 5 years after vaccination is approximately 74%, with confidence intervals of 35 to 90%. I put question marks for serogroup C and serogroup Y vaccine effectiveness, and this question is actually going to be really important for us to look at, but we don't have enough power to look at that quite yet. And I think over time we'll have estimates that are vaccine-specific, that are serogroup-specific, which will be really helpful. But what we have looked at, which is the concerning part of the study, is that vaccine effectiveness changes over time. So for persons who are vaccinated less than 1 year, in the first column you have all cases of meningococcal disease. In the second column, we've controlled and taken out the cases that had underlying illness that would put them at increased risk for meningococcal disease. So it's what I would call vaccine effectiveness in healthy persons. So in the first year, the vaccine is 99% effective, which is great. And then in years 1 to 2, the vaccine falls to be about 89% effective in healthy people. And it is interesting to note that it's only about 80% effective in all cases combined. So there's clearly less effectiveness in the underlying illness group, which we'll come back to in a little bit. But for persons vaccinated 2 to 5 years ago, vaccine effectiveness falls to 56%. And note that these confidence intervals are -48% to 87%, and so they're quite wide. And that's because, really, we've been doing the study over the past 5 years, and that group of people who were vaccinated several years ago, because if you look at how our coverage increases, isn't big enough to really assess vaccine effectiveness in this time period. But there's definitely a trend, and this trend fits with some of the other data that we've seen. And while this point estimate is 56% right now, it may go to 60 or 65, it may go to 50. It's clearly substantially lower than after vaccination in the first 2 years. So what's going on? And I think that's been a question that a lot of people have been asking about. I think what we know now is that immunologic memory, which is the which is one of the key parts of conjugate vaccines, is not enough to protect against meningococcal disease. And I like to say blame the bug, not the vaccine. We know that the boost response to exposure after you've been primed, so you've gotten that first dose and then you get exposed either through vaccination or through being exposed to the organism, it takes 5 to 7 days after the exposure. But the incubation period for Neisseria meningitidis is 1 to 4 days. So what's happening is people are getting the disease before their bodies had time to respond to that exposure and boost their antibody. So what we now understand is that we really need circulating antibody at the time of exposure. So circulating antibody wanes after conjugate vaccine, and we know that approximately 50 to 60% of persons vaccinated have titers above the required threshold for licensure 5 years after vaccination. Those numbers obviously are 93, 95% right after vaccination. And we're also unlikely getting the additional benefits of herd immunity with the current U.S. program. Our coverage is increasing slowly, but as I like to say, it's now over 60% because the NIS team's a year behind. But certainly in our population immunity is not 60% because a lot of those kids got vaccinated 4 and 5 years ago and their titers have fallen. So we haven't really achieved high coverage quickly enough to get herd immunity. So this slide shows the pre and post SBA titers. So this is the one immunogenicity slide that I really just want to point out. In the first column, you see you have good responses to vaccine 28 days after vaccine. In the second column, this is how the antibodies wane at 5 years. And they're really 99 is it's a geometric mean titer of a bunch of people vaccinated, but it's not very high above even people who had never been vaccinated before. But importantly, if you look in that 5 years post-vaccinated, the people who got their second dose of, in this study, Menactra, but I think definitely either meningococcal conjugate vaccine, really boost well above what their first dose was. So their titers there are 23,000 compared to 2,000 after that first dose. And so this is a slide that really shows you that over time. So if you look at your first dose, you get a boost. You increase your antibody levels. They decline over time. And then with exposure, which can be either vaccination or the disease, it takes several days. It takes 5 days. But then you really boost your antibody levels up much higher than you did after that first dose. And therefore, because your antibody levels start higher, it will take much longer for them to come down below protective levels. However, unfortunately, what happens is that when you're exposed with disease and not vaccine, you get disease before your body is able to mount that immune response. So we really need to get those antibody levels up quickly. And so the question that was sort of discussed over and over again is, what do you do to ensure adolescents are protected through this period of increased risk during ages 16 to 21 years? And there were really two options considered by ACIP, and one was to move a single dose to age 14 or 15 years. And then the second was to add this booster dose at age 16 years in addition to the 11 to 12-year-old dose. And I think there were a lot of discussions back and forth about the cost effectiveness and how we should, what would be the best way to do this. But ultimately, adding the booster dose prevents more cases of meningococcal disease, and it'll really give adolescents that boost that they need to be protected for longer periods of time. And so I think the decision was made in part because even though the burden of disease is very low, people felt like they needed two doses to be protected. So this slide is difficult to see, but I'll just run through it quickly. And I'm sorry, I've already gone over. But so for persons who are ages 11 to 18 years, they're recommended to get a single dose of meningococcal disease at age 11 or 12 years, and then they should get a booster dose at age 16 years. If they got that single dose, because we know only 50% of adolescents are getting it at 11 or 12 years right now, if we got that dose at age 13 through 15 years, we recommend a booster between 16 and 18 years. And if they got their first dose after their 16th birthday, then they no longer need a second dose. And I think I like to think of this as the DTAP recommendations for the fifth dose. The dose is at 4 to 6 years old, regardless of when they got for the fifth dose, regardless of when they got the fourth dose. And so they really need that dose after age 4 years. And here you really need a dose after age 16 years. And so it's really an age-based recommendation and not an interval-based recommendation. The second point I want to point out is that for persons who are HIV infected in this age group that's recommended, they should be getting a two-dose series 2 months apart for their initial series and then get the booster. And then we also updated recommendations for people ages 2 to 55 years with ACE1A or complement component deficiency, and that they should also be getting a two-dose primary series. And this is also a very similar theory. You really want to give them two doses to get their antibody levels up really high. And so what about, and these are the two questions that we've been getting a lot, what about college students who are ages 19 to 21 years? The guidance is that for colleges requiring vaccination, there should be documentation of a dose of meningococcal conjugate vaccine in the last 5 years for students entering college. And so we really didn't make a large-scale recommendation that colleges needed to go vaccinate all of their 19 to 21-year-olds who were already in college. But persons who are age 18 to 21-year-olds who are entering college would certainly be included in some of these recommendations, especially if they're living in dorms. Other persons aged 19 to 21 years would also benefit from vaccination, but it's not specifically recommended. And that's because we really want to focus on getting that booster dose in at ages 16 to 18 years, so you're protected through that entire period of risk, rather than making a recommendation of 16 to 21 years. Vaccination is really not recommended after age 21 years, unless you're in a high-risk group. And the final question is the interval between doses. So the booster dose can be administered any time after the 16th birthday to ensure the booster dose is provided. The minimum interval between doses is really just 8 weeks. And so this is not a time-based booster dose. It's really an age-based recommendation for that booster dose. And I think that's different than some of the other recommendations with Tdap. We always have these intervals, but this is different. And so this quickly, in the future, we'll be talking about infant vaccination and serogroup B vaccines. And then finally, there's just one update to the Tdap recommendations that I said I would say in this talk, because we didn't have a Tdap update. But ACIP recommends that pertussis vaccination, when indicated, should not be delayed and that Tdap should be administered regardless of the interval since the last tetanus and diphtheria toxoid-containing vaccine. And this taking away of the interval for Tdap that was implemented when the vaccines were first recommended hopefully will help with some of these issues of getting vaccine coverage up in adolescents, because people won't have to worry about when their last tetanus-containing vaccine was. And so that is it. I'd like to thank the health departments and the working group for really all the work they've done helping